Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Dr. Jack Gansler and Bill Lucian from the University of Maryland's School of Public Policy and authors of the IBM Center report, 8 Actions to Improve Defense Acquisition. So Jack and Bill, in your report, you outline the other area you focus in on is the use of best value trade-off source selection strategies for complex or most high knowledge content kind of work. And what I mean by that is the growing use of the lowest price technically acceptable, LPTA, as a source selection strategy. What's the problem with that and why is this happening? Why is this increasing around complex services?
Buying something on the basis of low price, technically acceptable LPTA. You wouldn't buy your car that way. You wouldn't get your heart surgeon that way. You wouldn't do it in the real world. You make your judgments on the basis of best value, the combination of performance and cost. Mm-hmm. But if it's just a plain, simple commodity, you might just say, well, that ketchup's as good as another ketchup, so I'll buy that one. It's lower cost.
So why do you see a propensity of contract officers using LPTA?
I think there's several reasons. One, it makes the source selection a little easier. If you qualify the bid as being technically acceptable, you just have to look at the price. That's one reason. The second reason, it makes it easier to immunize yourself against a protest. Mm-hmm. So when you have a best value source selection, best value trade-off source selection, it's a lot easier to find a problem in the source selection criteria or how it was implemented, and so there's more likely to be a protest. So when you use LPTA, I think you can sort of immunize yourself against a protest. And then finally, the intent is to save money. And so what contractors often talk about is a race to the bottom. So Wow. You've got this fear, you know, constantly just cutting costs and cutting costs. In the end, cutting the quality of the service that's provided to be able to win the award. And so those are the kinds of things that create a problem for the government when they overuse LPTA. And those are the reasons they try to use it.
So what can they do to use it more properly? What are some of the suggestions you folks have?
Well, limit where you use it. Okay. Limit it to the commodities, where it's complex weapon systems or complex services, value is important. But on the other hand, if it's the same thing that 5 different people are offering you as a commodity, then you can pick the lower cost. And you get, as Bill points out, you get rewarded in a sense because today affordability is one of the driving considerations. Uh-huh. And therefore, with a lower budget, we're going to try and pay attention to cost. But we don't want to get a lot of junk. And that's what you are driven to with the low price technically acceptable.
I think one of the other things you can do, Michael, is to ensure that you look at past performance, which isn't always done with LPTA type source selections. And so when you look at past performance, you could at least eliminate the poor performers or the people that haven't performed well on previous efforts.
So we talked about IDIQs. We talked about LPTA. I'd like to switch a little bit over to an effort to control growth. And periodically, DoD embraces fixed-priced contracts. Could you tell us a little bit more? Why are they often problematic, and when are they best used?
Well, the first thing is this: if it's a technological advancement, there's a high risk to using fixed price in that sense that you don't know if it'll work. It's a simple idea there. But you also want to create some incentives again. Now, a fixed price in a competition, how do you win it unless you bid low? And then what they count on is so-called buying in by bidding low and then counting on the thousands of changes that come along.
Well, cost-plus contracts reduce the transaction costs for making a lot of these changes when you have a lot of uncertainty in a program. And we have a lot of history where the DoD has tried to use fixed price contracts for development. And the programs have been generally unmitigated disasters. You had the C-5, which almost drove Lockheed to bankruptcy, the F-111, and recently, the most recent case was the A-12, which is still being litigated. And so all of this feeling that fixed price contracts will constrain the costs, in the end, it really doesn't. and it places often a lot of risk on a contractor. It's unacceptable risk and can really wind up costing the government a lot more than using, you know, more appropriate cost-plus contracts.
So what are some of the – what ways can the cost reimbursement contracts be used? Like, what are some of the actions you would prescribe?
The development programs are an appropriate place for them, I think. But with still monitoring, you give a bid back on a cost-based contract, you would need the government to either themselves or with one of their advisory groups, maybe private sector, telling you that that's overpricing. Oh. Or if you can do it in a competitive environment, that's even better, because you have two people in a on a cost-based contract. They'll say, oh, and that it doesn't really add to my costs. One of them will, and that one will win.
Well, the cost-plus contracts also place an additional burden on the government because there's potentially a tendency to gold-plate the system or put in unnecessary requirements because if people feel like it can be covered in the contract. So you really takes a lot more effort on the part of the government to monitor those contracts to make sure the requirements don't change any more than is absolutely required so the cost doesn't grow excessively. So I think it does take a little bit of extra work, but I think in the end it works out better.
There's almost a perverse incentive in the fixed price contract because I know what companies might tend to do is to say, I've got a better idea. Wouldn't you like to have this? And they say, of course we'd like to have it. Well, that means you're going to double the cost. In a cost-based contract, you may want to have a higher incentive to simply do a good job for the and get reimbursed for the cost. But in a fixed-price contract, you want to figure out some way to create a change so that you can get paid more for that, especially if you're the only one producing it.
In a certain way, is this sort of like the you really need a Yugo, but you're buying a Cadillac? I mean, is that a good metaphor in a sense?
No, in fact, I use that example frequently when people, you know, ask me what about the low price technically acceptable. Do you drive a Yugo? You know, that's the point. We don't select on that basis. But on the other hand, if we can't afford a Cadillac, we might buy something in between.
But I think the real key is then using the appropriate contract structure for the phase of the program you're in. So eventually you want to move to a firm fixed price contracts in the production phase of the program. But at least initially, often the cost plus contract is more appropriate. And so you don't want to proscribe which kinds of contracts the contracting officer should use. They should have all the tools they need for the breadth of the program.
And it really depends on the phase. You folks in your report mention or introduce a concept called dual-use industrial operations. And I'd like for you to maybe give our listeners some background on this concept. What exactly do you mean?
Well, the idea would be the same factory does both commercial and military work. And not just in the research phase, but in the production phase. And even in the maintenance phase, because you're very familiar with the work and you figure out how to, in a market environment with the commercial side, you learn how to do things more efficiently and effectively. And so you want to combine the two, partly for economies of scale, if you can put the two together in the same plant. I'll give you an example. Boeing was building commercial transports and military transports in the same plant in Wichita. They were basically forced by government regulations and oversight to separate these two. As a result of separating and building a commercial plant in California and building the military ones in Wichita, both prices went up. The commercial one went up because they lost economies of scale. But the forcing was done because of the government rules that discourage dual use, that discourage putting the two things together. And it even discourages commercial firms from supplying some of the lower tier stuff the bill was talking about to the primes. For example, if you have a dual-use plant, you have to use government cost accounting for the commercial stuff. And that's expensive. It's a totally different form than the normal commercial cost accounting system. Also, if you have a commercial stuff, it's a discouragement to a commercial supplier to work on a defense program. I'll give you a simple example, again, because the stories, I think, make it a lot easier to understand it. Boeing had to pay $15 million to export a 767. That's a commercial transport. Why is anyone worried about that? Because in the electronics, they had a single chip that was also in the Maverick missile. and the Maverick missiles subsystems were under export control. And by Boeing shipping a commercial transport, that chip was a commercial chip. Mm-hmm. And by shipping this big airplane, they had to pay $15 million to allow them to export it. It's foolish.
Yeah.
But this discourages commercial firms from doing defense work. And yet often these commercial firms are more advanced than the defense work. Something people don't know about is that today when you compare the investment in research from private sector industry, commercial industry, mm-hmm. against the government's investment, the commercial is twice the government's investment. And so why wouldn't we want to take full advantage of this? In order to maintain our technological superiority, we should use commercial stuff more.
How can DOD work to open competition to non-traditional commercial firms? I mean, you alluded to it, but can you expand on it a little bit?
Yeah, change the rules.
Change the rules.
I mean, there is in the federal acquisition regulations in the FAR, there's an attempt. FAR Part 12 is supposed mm-hmm. to be for buying commercial stuff, but a lot of the contracting people don't understand that. The intent was to really get the ability to buy commercial things. And instead, they still try to apply all these rules to the commercial stuff and some of the cost accounting, the export controls, things of that sort. The commercial firms just say no thank you mm-hmm. because they have to be competitive in the commercial world.
Well, if they do participate, they'll set up a separate operation to deal specifically with the government so they can maintain separate books, separate procedures, and not mix the two operations. And in the end, we lose because we don't get the economies of scale. We don't get the cross flow of technologies and information in the way we'd like.
There have been some separate studies done about what the cost of all of that regulation is. In a long time ago, I had Coopers and Lybrand do a study. It was 18% at that time. More expensive if you have to build a commercial item with government regulations. Now, the Air Force has given some speeches recently saying that now up to 25%. And there are some independent studies done by government agencies that said it's up to 30%. For the same item built to government regulations in a government-regulated facility, versus in a commercial operation. And so that's what Bill was talking about. Why do we want to do that? Yeah. Well, because it's the law.
What does the future hold with the federal acquisition workforce? We'll find out when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.